Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
There you are.
There you are.
On your way.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to
the Brady Bunch. Wait,
the Brady Bunch. Oh my gosh, we need more guests. Welcome to our first episode of Vox Vomitus of 2022. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the author of Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, as well as the Hotel series and Pretty Ugly. Joining me, as always, is my Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martin, author of The Bourbon Books, which includes Dibs Since September and Move On Melinda. And Dibs is a very recent award-winning novel, so again, we're still celebrating that from a few weeks ago.
Still drinking about that. We started to drink about it. I'm not really sure.
Who knows? There's no rules here in internet land.
No.
With us today is our fantastic guest, Kim Taylor Blakemore.
And she's here.
Yes. And she is here to talk about the writing process in general and also her historic mystery, After Alice Fell, which I just have to say, and I know I say this all the time on the show, we love the book. I just finished it 2 days ago, and Once again, we get a great book that checks off so many of the things I look for in a novel.
I swear, you seriously are just looking for New England, New Hampshire authors, and you just go, so does someone die in New Hampshire? I need that book.
Well, but Kim's not a New Hampshire native. So I didn't expect an asylum, a lunatic asylum in New Hampshire, of all places, which
you
for
guys
people,
have a lot of lunatics.
We do. For people who are unfamiliar with me, I live in New Hampshire. It's a small state, which in historic mysteries tends to have a lot of death.
And lunacy.
Yes.
Kim, where are you?
I'm in Oregon, which has a lot of death and lunacy, too, because of the
You
bang.
Really do. Oh, and a lot and of serial killers.
And serial killers.
Bigfoot. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say Pacific Northwest, you're in like serial killer territory.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all from there.
Yeah, exactly.
See, this is the difference between our genres because she's like serial killer and I'm still on. So tell me more about Bigfoot. You're like, there's no Bigfoot in my book. That's okay. Can we write him in the sequel? A sequel where it's an asylum for insane Sasquatch and go.
I know. I was going to say for big feet.
I'm wearing sloth slippers. Does that count?
Yes. You're dressed like a Bigfoot. I don't know.
My feet are not that big, but that's okay.
I wouldn't think they are because we're the same size.
No, we're small.
So anyways, Kim, about you. Tell our viewers and our listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about After Alice Fell.
Okay. Well, I already said I'm from the state of serial killers and Bigfoot. So we can just start right there. The only way to stay sane in the rain is to do things like write and drink.
Those two things often go hand in hand.
I drink coffee. I don't drink. I drink coffee, but it keeps me up through all the gray days. So yeah. So I write historical thrillers and historical suspense. And they're the three that I have. I have two out, The Companion and After Alice Fell, are both in New Hampshire in the same town, as is the next one coming out, The Deception. And so they're in the three decades. So 1855 is The Companion, 1865 is After Alice Fell, and 1877 is The Deception.
Okay, you got to tell us how you're set everything then in this state when you're in Oregon. Yeah. What's the inspiration for the opposite coast?
Yes.
Because you knew some of the names of the towns.
Yes, because I love New Hampshire and I've been out there twice for research. But when I first started writing The Companion, it was really gothic. And I said, where in the U.S. is really gothic? That same sort of English vibe, right? Lots of woods and mill towns that are falling apart and trains that go nowhere.
And people with secrets that don't want to talk about their emotions.
Exactly.
That everything is just like right under the surface.
Or the surface of water. You know, it depends. People drown a lot.
I don't know. Well, but so I was looking for it and then I started going, well, New England has all of that. And then I really just thought, where can I set for the first one where is a small mill town? What river and whatever? So I was literally took a map out and started looking at some history and went like this. And I was right on the Kuntukuk River. Yes. I'm like, oh, that's right by Peterborough. Peterborough, however you say it.
It is Peterborough.
Okay. All right. Because my town's name is Harborough.
So not Borough.
Harborough. Yep. You're even saying it with a New England accent.
Yeah.
It's like Harrowborough.
Harrowborough. In my head, it was Harrowborough until somebody said, you're an idiot. And it was the narrator. It was the woman who narrated the book, The Companion. She's from Keene. So we were talking about the book. She's like, you pronounce everything wrong.
Well, what's funny is
I'm like, oh my God.
I grew up in southern New Hampshire, so I don't have that like Harborough, or I can't even do it accent. So in my head, it was still Harborough.
Yes.
I went to school for theater. My accent has been beaten out of me. Harborough.
Well, and I like that. I know that Keene's a real place. Keene, spelled K-E-E-N-E, is my maiden name. So I've had many people say, oh, do you have family from there? I didn't even know till I was a grown-up that that is a place. I'm going, we have a town?
Yeah.
No, we have a town.
You even have there's a college there, too.
There's a college. No one sent me there. Sorry.
It's a great town. Jennifer, you're between Concord and Keene, right? Almost smack between the two.
I'm smack between the two. Yeah. And I worked in Concord. I still work in Concord. Yeah. So I got very excited during your book when it was like, oh, we're taking, you know, are you going up to Concord? Are you going here? So I was like, where is she? Because she's not in Concord and it's not Manchester. And I thought you were in Keene. But then somebody said, oh, like so-and-so went to Keene. And I'm like, oh, they're not in Keene. They must be in Peterborough.
Perfect. That is I'm excellent. A detective. Annie. Hello. Annie. Hello. I haven't seen her in ages. So fun.
Annie is the reason you're on this show.
Really?
Yes.
Annie's a superstar. She's hilarious.
She's amazing. And there was one time that we had a guest canceled too late. And I messaged Annie and I was just like, do you have authors that like, you know me, you know our show that we would love? And she said, you and Tanya Mitchell.
Tanya, yes.
So Tanya came in like, I can be there next week. And we were like, yes.
Thank you.
Perfect. Yeah. Now, you know there's an asylum in Concord.
Yes, I do. It's now state offices.
Isn't that odd?
I knew somebody who worked at the state offices who allowed us the use of their key.
Love how cryptic you're being right now. Because this person's going to get fired if you finish the story.
It's just a story. She's making
it's up. It's just a story. I am a fiction. We were allowed to, with supervision from somebody who might work at the state offices, we were allowed to go into the kitchen and the tunnels. But most of the buildings are blocked off.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Annie says where she loves you all.
For people who haven't read After Alice Fell, it starts at the beginning with the woman, Marion, who's in the morgue of an asylum, and she's identifying the body of her sister Alice. And the asylum says she committed suicide, and Marion says there's absolutely no way she committed suicide. So the entire book is trying to find out the truth of what happened to her sister. And then you get all the New Hampshire secrets and lies and all that stuff and people dying underwater and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. There's always a pond. There's always a pond. On your property.
They're everywhere. You guys have so many ponds and trees. It's like crazy. I thought Oregon had trees. No, you guys have the trees.
I recently moved to Deering, and when my friends came to help us move, they were just like, they drove to our house and they were like, where do you live? This is just like all swamps and woods. And they referred to it as murder country. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, there you
go. That's about it. It's beautiful though.
Allison, where are you?
See, I'm in Orange County, California.
Oh, very good. I went to UC Irvine.
Oh, okay. So my husband actually teaches a writing course with UC Irvine for kids. So
fantastic. Like,
we have Irvine here all the time represented in the house. But I always laugh because we never get books set in Orange County, because other than Dean Koontz, nobody writes books set in Orange County. He's the only person willing to kill people off.
Christopher Pike Didn't Christopher Pike write?
I don't
write
know. I know that Christopher Rice, Anne Rice's son, was writing some books set in California, but they were more, if I'm remembering correctly, they were like Inland Empire kind of high desert area. They weren't here.
That's another murder sort of place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we don't have a lot of, we just don't get exciting things happening here. Everybody's just like,
you have Disneyland.
Yeah. You have Disneyland, you have Sun.
We have Sun.
Yeah. You have Sun.
It's not a great, like my most recently completed book, I have stuff specifically set in Orange. So anyone who ever reads that will get something set in a place I actually know. Old Town Orange.
Fun.
Yes.
That's fun.
So that's Kim, so cool. First I want to say, I love your style of writing. It was so poetic and literary. And I felt like so much of it, if you just like broke down the lines, it would have read is like this stunning poem about like grief and trauma while still being a mystery. So I love that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to touch on is, I think my favorite part of almost every book is when I read the acknowledgement section. And I love it when the authors are honest during their acknowledgement section and say things like, this took 6 drafts, or thank you everybody that turned this from a mess to what you're reading now.
And I think
you wrote something in your acknowledgements like 6 drafts or something like that, or like thank you for saving this book. So this is why you're here, to talk about the process.
Yes, the process.
So I mean, it's historical, so obviously I'm assuming you started with a ton of research.
Yes. So yeah, it's a lot of research, and I tend to research more. A lot of the research of that was done before COVID. So I was able to go to New Hampshire twice, and I went to the archives and was able to look through jail things. I was not able to get into the asylum, unlike you.
She doesn't have a friend with
but
a key.
I have like a creepy Google Earth, and I Google Earth the hole where the asylum was and
oh,
all
nice.
That. And went to the state library, got a lot of stuff from there. So I really like primary sources rather than reading things that are later. So I will first, when I'm doing the research, I stop researching the year the book takes place. So I don't want to really know how people think past that time. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
no, that makes a lot of sense, because you want to get in that mindset of what those characters and what they were drawing from. And one of the things, as far as I'm not a huge history buff, even though I was a history minor, so you'd think I should be, but having that in the back of the, like, it was the war. The war was going on, and how the war, because it's just post-Civil War, and your main character was a nurse, although she hadn't been trained as a nurse, who then was out there and used that kind of as an escape from the life she was leading. Mm-hmm. And people were looking at her like, how dare you? It's like, well, there's a war going on.
I know.
I think that's kind of a big deal. And we look back, and this war still is a huge thing in our history. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's like, you know, this disrupted our plant and the mill and people's jobs, rather than, oh, and a lot of people died.
Yeah, I mean, you see it in that book, particularly the loss and you know, putting the same loss in that she has, and the woman down the street who lost both of her sons in the war and has the house and can't afford it because there was no pensions. And then, you know, just there's loss everywhere from that. But I love research, and I love going in person. So during COVID has been difficult. So the new book has been completely researched online, which is
it just, is it like a closed room mystery, but the room happens to be in New Hampshire?
No, it is. It's not a closed room mystery. I had some great conversations. I had a conversation with a guy who knows every single type of carriage that was made at this place in New Hampshire.
That's a really obscure
and he wants me to come.
Knowledge.
No, he wanted me to come. He's like, I will drive you all over the state, because there's this one that has 18 people and 6 horses, and then I'll take you to this one at this person's farm that's a 2-seater.
Is he Amish?
He's not. He just knows.
Because if he is, I don't know how he's talking to you on the phone.
There's a really, really...
Sorry.
People here love that. We love our history.
Oh,
there's a lot of, like...
Yeah.
The historical societies around here.
Every historical society I went to, all of them on both trips, they were amazing. The people were amazing. They're like, come on.
They must just be so happy to share this information.
Somebody cares.
Somebody cares about the carriages.
I went to the one in Keene, and like there was three women down in the basement area where they just had like cases of glass that was made there and scissors and the types of plates and stuff. And they said, "You want to come see this other room?"
These are probably my relatives.
Sure. So they open this door in this basement. And there's this like horrible room with just like things all on shelves and
oh, that's
and
amazing. Bricks.
There's all these bricks, and I'm like, "What the heck?
Why?
What room is this?"
And she picks one up, and she's like, "Do you see this brick? We have to catalog every one of these that came from a building in town." And then she's like, "Every one."
Oh,
puts it down.
Has she escaped from the asylum?
Because
I think they're going to end up in the asylum. They're going to end up there. It's like, oh my God. I'm like, what? And she said, people just drop everything off. They think it's historic, but these bricks come from a real building that's historic. So we have to code every single one.
If it came from the building, can we just put it back in the building and call it good?
I think that what we're going to do was try and recreate some buildings. I think that's why there are archiving the stuff, but
didn't oh my gosh, you never think about how many bricks are in a building until you have to catalog them,
piles of them.
Yeah, but I know why they do things like that, because back when I was in high school, and I don't know exactly why we did this, my high school youth group went and we remudded, that's a thing, a historical log cabin in Virginia, and we're sitting there and like they removed all, we took out the old mud and put in new mud. Why? I'm still not sure.
They did it to keep your kids busy and off drugs and having sex.
No, it probably, I didn't say that didn't happen. I said, this is what we were doing during the daytime. And we also had to put on a new roof. And this is also where I learned that no matter how thick your soles are, a bent nail can go through the side of your shoe. And I'm really glad I got my tetanus shot before I went.
Oh, this is awful.
But yeah,
awful.
I know that that's a thing.
That's awful.
You have to keep like the original, so much of the original stuff. So it's like, well, here are the bricks, and now we have new mortar, I guess. But I don't want to catalog. That sounds terrible.
They were just happy to have someone down there so they could like complain about the bricks, but show me all the other stuff. So I'm like,
It's people like you who make people who volunteer and work at historical societies. It makes it worthwhile, or else it's just cataloging bricks, and every once in a while probably a kid has to come in for like a report
for a field trip
and they don't want to be there. They're going to be like, yeah, bricks.
I could have gone to the aquarium.
When you talk to them, and I had a rock star librarian that I worked with at the state library for both the companion and this book, and I was able to say, this is the story. So in the companion, it's a woman who may or may not have killed two women in the house she worked at. Ooh. So I said, this is the story, and she's in prison, and I've spent a year trying to figure out in 1855 where she would be, and I couldn't find anything.
Like what prison you mean?
There was no women's prison. And courts worked very differently. Like, you waited 3 months for the Court of Common Pleas people to come through to even do your case, and the people who did the accusation paid for everything.
So where was someone who was a... Where was someone who was a suspect kept in the meantime?
A lot of them would have a cell at the, whether it's at the station or some place. Mm-hmm. They'd be kept with the sheriff. In Connecticut, there's a story I'm researching now that the sheriff keeps one of the people at his house because she's nice and she knows how to use men. So he's like, you can stay at my house. Okay.
We can share covers.
So, but anyway, so this woman, she's like, oh, I'll look through the archives. This is fantastic. And she found all the prison reports from 1849 on. And she's like, you need 1855. It has the warden, the doctor, the minister, an inventory of everything in the prison. And then through that, what happened in the year, what was built, what was fixed, what was repaired, every single person, why they were there and for how long. If you stole a horse,
that's
it was
incredible.
7 years. Right?
Joe Compton says, I would turn those bricks into a stage play of the Cask of Amontillado.
Nice. Excellent.
But don't visit Joe's house. Okay.
Yeah, so she found all those for me so I could see that the women were kept above the warden's rooms. So the warden's family would lived at the prison, the men's prison, and the women, six women, lived upstairs and they served the family.
Oh, you know what?
So, I mean, so she did that. And then when I did the next one, I said, hey, I'm going to do a thing in an asylum. Want to go with me? I said, I'm coming back to New Hampshire. We're going to get in the asylum. I think I'll set the book in Concord. But we couldn't get in.
Yeah.
But she did find the records from the doctors there. So you have no cases. You don't know that. But I was able to then take that asylum and move it and make it a fictional one in the fictional town.
See, and I was wondering, because I know you had mentioned the asylum in Concord, and then I was like, oh, was there a smaller one in Peterborough?
Yes, in my head.
Because the one in Concord, as you know, because you've seen it, I'm sure, is massive. Yeah. It's more than one building.
Yes. They took, at the time, the Quakers had built those, and it was about having people who had dis-ease have fresh air and industry. So there was, they had their own animals. They did everything within there.
Okay, yes. Industry. Did they actually give them needles then? Because reading that scene, and it's not a huge spoiler, so I apologize. There's a scene where Marion's touring this place and everybody's sewing and none of them got needles. And they're just like, look at me sewing.
You know what? Don't tell anyone else, but I have no effing idea.
I just love that.
That's weird. That's totally weird.
It was such a creepy scene because where they're like,
if you think about it, would you give one of those people a needle?
No.
Get me out of the asylum.
No. And I will say, this isn't funny, but in the early 1950s, my grandmother was actually in Concord, in the asylum in Concord.
Oh, really?
And my mother remembers on Sundays, they would allow families to come and picnic, and they would walk the patients to the window and let them like wave between the bars at their family and then like go away.
That's odd.
Even up until the asylum in Concord closed down, I think they were still providing, like the steam industry was there. It heated all of downtown Concord. Yeah. People worked in like the steam rooms.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's sad.
You know,
waving
it's
through the window.
Yeah. Put that in your book.
And I'm just another book. I'm thinking of a similarly sad scene.
Yes, you should.
When my mom was going through chemo treatment, she couldn't have kids in the room, and I was pregnant at the time, but my sister already had her eldest daughter. My sister would go down in the parking lot and like parade by with the baby who could wave at my mom. But that's the visual I'm getting there of, you know, we can't see you, but sort of.
And I think a lot of people went through this during COVID.
Yeah.
Too.
We're like doing
with
that.
Nursing homes. We're doing that still.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
So you start with your research. You have a ton of research. You have a ton of helpers.
Yeah.
What is your first draft like? Is it factual or do you add the facts in later? Like,
I just, well,
is it word vomit?
No, I tend to, for After Alice Fell, I didn't know what I was going to write. And I just got on a plane. I was talking to my brother. I said, I wrote The Companion. I don't know what's next. I think I want to do this sort of pseudo-Western. He's like, you need to do another gothic.
That was not pseudo-Western.
Okay. This is not pseudo-Western.
Just checking. Did I miss something?
No, I wanted to because I have this book that I'm still working on that's sort of my, well, anyway, that's not neither here nor there. It's a different book. But I got on an airplane and I just opened this notebook and pulled out a pencil and I just wrote New Hampshire 1865, The Asylum, and just started writing on the plane. And the very first scene is what I wrote on the plane. I mean, if I could pull off the wall, because I put on the wall the first page of my books, or did when I hand wrote them, now I type them. So that doesn't look as pretty on the wall. But yeah, and so it was just that. It just started with that. And who's Marion? Marion, and who is this woman? And then I just go from there. So then I tried to try and like create some form of a story from that.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you said that. Just some form of a story. I don't know.
Well, I don't think I write mysteries. I write more suspense. You can know who in anything, but there's no surprise. Like, oh my gosh, it's that person who did it. It's like,
yeah, well, there's, I love the difference between a whodunit and a whydunit.
Yes. So yeah. Whydunits are to me are more suspense, right? So
it's but there like, were a lot of whys in your book. There were a lot of whys that were revealed everything. And I don't want to say all of them, but there were a lot more whys than just what happened with Alice. That was just like the mm-hmm. starting one. And right. I will take issue with your first scene. A, I loved it. But B, I just kept telling Jen, and she's like, it's not Alice, and just stop, is I wanted it to be related to Alice in Wonderland, because I wanted it to be that Alice come back, and it says right in the beginning that the cause of death, mania. I'm like, well, yeah, if she came back from Wonderland, she'd be kind of screwed up.
I know, Allison's like, probably. Can you just tell me, is it Alice in Wonderland
and
related?
Like, it's not. I'm like, are you sure, though? I probably was about halfway done before I'm like, okay, it's not. I finally give up. It's not. It's I will not, stop trying to make fun. It happen.
That would be brilliant.
But well, and both Jen and I think we both have read a book that's called Just After Alice that yeah. isn't really yeah. based that's on the, that, but it's Gregory Maguire, but it's, right. you know, he writes all the fairy tale stuff, and Jen's like, it's not, it's an asylum. Stop. Like, but she used the word Alice. Like, stop it. The name does not mean anything other than that's the name of the
that,
person.
That name is iconic, isn't it?
It is.
You immediately think Alice. And I even tried to change her name because I thought that. It's no, Alice. And I'm
but
like, that's
certain
her
characters,
name.
They just, the name just becomes part of them, and isn't you cannot true? Change their name.
Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the title was perfect because
oh, yeah.
everybody has that iconic image of Alice in Wonderland
falling.
And now to like superimpose it on like yeah. somebody else, I was like, oh, love it.
Especially
and I love the
because,
name Alice. So.
Well, and especially because she is a character who is not all right in the head, as they say. And that's a lot of figuring out more about who she is and why she's like this. And why did she get committed? That's one of the biggest whys that goes through there. And the way you describe her, I loved all of that. So, I mean, I'm mostly teasing about the whole, what do you mean this isn't Alice in Wonderland? I wanted to have a tea party because I'm glad it didn't go that direction because it's yeah. been done. You know, like, I don't think there would have been as many surprises and revelations.
I can't
you,
do Gregory Maguire.
That's
he's
okay.
brilliant
he
as,
does
he,
it.
As he is.
He's fine. Like, you yeah, do you, him, let him
exactly.
do him. And yeah. the scenes with the, I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but I loved even just the old style. And I'm sure somebody probably had to help you with the research about the, like the slideshows. I love that little bit of entertainment that like, oh, we're going to put up slides and that they're painted slides. And mm-hmm. my 6-year-old right now has been trying to make a projector out of a mirror and a shoebox. And he really wanted my cell phone. Like, you can't have my cell phone. I need my cell phone. But I ripped a mirror out of my eyeshadow case because he wouldn't stop bugging me. I'm like, fine, you can have this. And I'm just thinking, is this what they did in After Alice to make a projector? They used
that
a mirror
projector.
And
so those projectors, the first time I heard about them was when I was researching Valerie Girl a long time ago. And Jacob Riis wrote a book called How the Other Half Lives in New right. York City. Right. He was the first person who showed the underside of the Bowery and the immigrants and the poor. In the Gilded Age, and he took a ton of photographs. So he would go all around the country or the East, and he had a magic lantern. And because he would take those photographs, the slides, and project them on walls. So he would go to Hillsborough or Deering. That's where you're from. Deering?
Yep.
Deering.
But
he would go
use
and write on the brick
post
wall and project these huge images to show people who didn't understand and didn't know how bad the poverty was at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to the Museum of the City of New York to see the slides that he had. And they took me upstairs and I got to wear all the gloves. And there's some that were really, I really wanted to see. And she goes, okay, I'll go get them for you. Now, I, in my head, because they've been on my computer, I'm expecting these slides, these photos, right? They're like literally this big.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, really? Really? I came all the way out here to
see this
no,
to be like,
it's here,
big.
It's this.
And you're like,
because
lovely.
It went in that projector. So that was sort of that idea. And I said, I've always wanted to use that, those magic lanterns. You can still buy them, you know. You get on eBay, type
so
in magic
eBay
lantern.
Has everything.
And everything.
Don't tell my kid he'll want one.
Yeah, they sound really cool.
I want an extended version of this book that has like extras in it, like pages from Alice's journal
oh, yeah.
and her drawings and like color illustrations. So get on that.
If I had any sense of art, I could do it, but I'm terrible.
Okay, then you'll have to work with Jen on that.
Somebody else do it. That would be really interesting. You know, one of the things in that book is I really wanted Alice to have a voice. Mm. She doesn't speak, and she's dead.
Well, there's that.
So there's two things. She has no voice because she is dead.
And because she doesn't speak, because she stopped speaking at 14. But I really wanted her to have a voice. That was really important to me. That she did, because she's one of those people that is forgotten and cast aside.
Yeah.
The odd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. She like broke my heart so much. And I was so intrigued by her. Because she seemed, especially like through the eyes of her nephew, to be like this otherworldly person.
Yeah, she was like magic to him.
She was magic. Yeah.
Well, I feel like the nephew was the only one who really understood her, who really was able to communicate with her. And I think that's one of the things. And I have a big soft spot in my heart for people who are nonverbal and who don't necessarily communicate through the ways that everybody else does. And that doesn't mean that they're any less. Like, there's always a presumption, oh, well, if they aren't speaking, they must not have anything to say. And that's just completely wrong.
Right.
We just don't necessarily know how to listen. And he was the only one who did. Everybody else is just like, she's a burden. She's this, she's that.
Yeah.
And you know, one of my children is, she's not nonverbal. She speaks plenty, but she communicates mostly through her art. And so did Alice. And I totally saw that connection there. And just even our understanding of how people who don't have the same standard neurotype were treated 10 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. Back then, I mean, Alice, she stopped speaking at a specific point, but selective mutism, which is a bad term, but mutism in general, and situational mutism and trauma-induced mutism are huge things. And people just are like, we don't know what to do with you.
And the thing is if Alice had stopped talking when she was two, people would have said she was a changeling.
Probably, yeah.
Weird, you know?
But she probably wouldn't have started talking before too. She would have babbled and then just didn't progress beyond babbling.
Yeah.
But all those things, just how they handled it. But I loved how you handled the fact that there was trauma involved there, and no one wanted to look into that. They're just like, oh well, I'll manage her, and then I'm tired of managing her, and no one comes to visit because she's there, and all of that just was heartbreaking. But I thought it was very interesting, though, then the whole who's coming to visit and the social status, because then it's turned around then later with Kathy.
Kathy.
My favorite thing about Kathy.
I have so many Kathy friends, but I'm just like, Kathy.
Like Kathy.
The favorite thing about Kathy was Kathy's like outfits. And every time Marion like describes what she's wearing, it's always just like, it's a skirt made, it has sunflowers. And then her shawl has peacocks. And then it's this. And I'm like,
right. It's like, aren't you supposed to be in mourning?
Yeah.
We did for 7 whole minutes.
She did it 7 whole minutes. And she's like, bury the girl.
Bury the girl. I'm wearing all of the patterns.
Yes. Also, Toby, eat your food. I'm going to dump some salt on it and now eat it.
Oh my gosh, Kathy.
Kathy.
All of the characters, I just like loved and hated all of them. Like I just was like obsessed with this family.
I didn't hate Toby. I didn't hate Alice. I mean, everybody.
And then there was all the asylum people. Right,
I loved, but
Kitty.
I loved Kitty. I just was like,
oh, Kitty's. Kitty. You know, you talk about writing process. She's a character who just showed up.
Right? I get
literally
that.
The scene where she's running by the carriage, Mrs. I'm like, who are you?
Who are you? I get that. So
is she your Agnes?
Because I have a character in my Victorian era asylum books named Agnes who literally showed up. Just being like a brat, and then all of a sudden she was like one of the main characters, and I'm like,
all of a sudden I am the plot of the book.
That is, I know, so I'm like, fun. Oh my god, she's so important to it now.
Yeah, isn't that so fun?
I think it may be this asylum thing that the asylums just have a cast of characters that you start writing. They're like, would you like one of our inmates? Here you go.
And you're like, that never happened to me. I know. Do you want to come see what's in this room? No. And they open the door, and it's Kitty.
No, we don't.
Do you want to come to floor 5? Right? Like, sure.
Okay. Yeah.
There isn't one, but I'll go.
How high is the roof? Oh, how high is it up on that part? Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, yeah, Kitty was a great character. She was another one that I was like, we need a short story about Kitty and the extended hardcover version about this, a Kitty origin story.
I love Kitty. There are some people that I wish that I could write other books around, and I might when I get time. It's like, even if they're novellas, right?
Like, yeah, like a collection of short stories.
I've never written a short story. I'm like afraid of them.
So
you should be. They're terrible. No, just kidding.
No, they're terrifying.
There's no wiggle room in them.
There isn't.
No, there isn't.
And it's interesting because I've read a ton of short stories and I've written a ton of short stories, and I've never written a short story that I'm like, yes, this is a good short story, because I realize the way I write, you can't shorten it beyond a certain point before you've lost everything. Like, and that's a fail. All right.
Yeah.
That's just not my thing. That's okay.
I went through a phase about a year and a half, where I'm like, I'm going to write some short stories.
How'd that work out for you?
Not good.
You've never sent me one.
They're not good. No, I think one is pretty good, but it's more experimental. And I feel like at this point, it doesn't really read like a short story. It reads like a weird long poem.
Ooh, that could be a thing.
That's cool.
Which could be a thing. But I was like, but there's no beginning, middle, and end. There's just these things are happening.
But I
there's
think just that like a middle. Stories, they don't have to have beginning, middles, and ends. I hear.
They can be a slice of things. I don't know.
I'm afraid of them.
And I've read, I mean, some of my favorites, I love the Neil Gaiman collections. They're really good. And I've also done a lot of the like best of anthologies. Mm-hmm. But even with the best of anthologies, I'll read an entire anthology and go, there was one in here that I liked and the rest of this was a waste. Sorry, they didn't do anything for me. And I think it's part of it is the things that drive me are less concept driven and less twists. And, you know, how can we make this little thing just kind of a twist at the end? And more about relationships and story arc. And it's hard to do that in small spaces. So if you can do that, amazing. And if you can't, I'm not going to hate you.
The idea of like taking characters that people might already know, like characters that you've already written that we already have a relationship with, and maybe write a short story or something about them, because then we don't have to, as you're like loyal readers, we don't have to be introduced to Kitty because we know her.
Or just let Jen write the fan fiction for it.
I'll just write fan fiction.
Fan fiction does. It Kim comes Taylor in with relationships with characters.
That'd be hilarious.
And worlds already established. So if we find Jen writing archive like of your own.
If my agent is watching this now, I'm going to get like a message to me saying like, can you please finish your book before you start writing fan fiction based on After Alice Fell.
Yeah.
I am finishing my book.
When's your deadline?
We aren't talking about deadlines. We're not talking about deadlines.
I need to have something to her this month.
I have my edits are due on Monday for the new book. And
sorry, God.
So if I'm talking like a weirdo ever, just tell me, because I'm just, you know how you get, this is a part of the writing process that I don't think people know. It's when you get to edits and you doubt every single thing you ever wrote in the book.
Uh-huh.
So, right? Yeah. And so I've got
even certain drafts from my editor. Can just be like, this isn't even a thing.
I've been told mine aren't.
We all have.
I have to say my editor's amazing, and she gives me amazing ideas that I say like, hey, why didn't I think of that? That's brilliant. So I have all that. So you'd think I'd have a roadmap, but no, I have to spend 3 hours trying to change one line of dialogue because I have to, you know, and it's like, nobody's going to care. Like today, I'm like, nobody's going to care.
Can it just be gone? If it's that problematic, can we just get rid of it? No one's going to notice.
It has to be perfect, right? You know, that's when you're that late in that edit that's going out, it's like, oh my God. I'm just like, I have two scenes that I'm totally rewriting. Like, they have to be completely rewritten. Like, you're insane.
Like, did they really have to be totally rewritten? We get where you are in the process.
You get where
you're like,
right? You know,
like, you know what I should do? Completely scrap my whole plot.
I'm just going to throw the whole thing. Yeah, I'll have you a new thing by Monday. It's a different story. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. I know I did not do what you asked for, but I can easily do that by tomorrow.
Yeah,
exactly. Here's my 95,000 words.
Here are my bricks.
Want to see my brick catalog?
Which brick would you like?
I can definitely build a house out of this.
You have until Monday, and go.
And then in the middle of it, my computer is dying. So it's I'm trying to save, and it's 20 minutes of a spinning ball.
No. Not the spinning wheel of death.
The spinning wheel of death. Like more than once, days right of this.
Okay, I shouldn't say this on my computer because it's listening, like literally listening through the microphone. But mine has been doing this thing on, I don't want a new computer. I don't want a new computer. Where it just, it doesn't turn on most days. It just has to go. Just keep pushing the button repeatedly. And then eventually it does. Every time it has. But every day I'm like, is this going to be the day I've got to drive down to Micro Center and buy a new computer day of because I got a show to do? And it always turns on, but it usually takes
the exact problem my computer has as well. Like hit the button, nothing happens. Hit the button, nothing happens.
Mine, everything lights up. And sometimes if I hold it down, it sounds like the beginning of Erasure's chorus. And it's like,
sometimes mine doesn't do anything. The lights go on and then off, and I'm like, but no noise happens.
I wish that I still hand wrote at times like this.
But you know what you can't do? You can't do a podcast with handwriting. It doesn't work that
way. They call that pen pals.
Pen pals.
Hello, guest. How are you?
And then we will send you the transcript.
Then we just read aloud into like a CB radio.
Kim's breaker
19. Kim said there was a pile of bricks over
984 brick calling in.
I think Kim actually is in an asylum. Or she will be by the time being due.
Well, I'm really thrilled that you came here on like just several days before your edits are due for taking the time out of
sorry.
Sorry about that.
No, I'm happy. I'm happy for it.
We're a distraction.
Really, really good. No, I've been waiting for this.
Don't do it.
I'm like, for people watching the video, my hands are orange. I color boosted my hair.
They're gold. They look like shiny gold.
But we are hoping you will get to those edits and you figure out that whatever that scene needs to be, and it's just perfect. And you know, maybe ask your editor, can you give me a little guidance right on this line? Like what
she'll be like that one word.
Want just like a roadmap. Just write it for me. What you want changed there. Just write it. It's fine.
Instead of just saying this needs some work, just be like, could you rewrite that line the way it works?
Yeah.
Could you tell me how it works?
Like that.
Could you words for me?
Like if you were to write it,
trying to act like I'm so like, you know, I know everything, right? I know how to do this. You know what it's like. You doubt. There's doubt always. Yeah. And I think if we didn't have it as writers, we'd have very mediocre material.
We would be insufferable.
I might have been talking to a friend about that today, but I won't
really.
We were talking to each other about other people who that is kind of some people's attitudes who are just like, I don't need anyone to tell me how to do things, and here's my work, and people can take it or leave it, and they're mostly leaving it. And so he's like, I don't really want to help somebody with a marketing component if they're not willing to put in the work in the draft of a good product component. And I'm like, I think you're correct that if you're not willing to put in the work on your craft, then maybe doing the marketing, you're putting the effort in the wrong place.
Right.
Kind
of might want to think about that.
Yeah.
Just think about having a good story to begin with.
Maybe. Or strong prose. Those are both good things to have.
Exactly.
Really like, you know, compelling characters. Something that's, you know, you have all of that.
Yeah, you do.
Thank you.
You just got to fix that, whatever that line is.
Fix that one sentence, like, whatever that is.
You know how they're like lines of dialogue you think can change the tenor of the scene in the next scenes to come. And if they're not exactly right, it's like, it's muddy. That just muddy.
When you're at that point in the process, do you say the words out loud? Like, I always find, like, especially dialogue, if I don't say it, don't figure out where the characters are breathing,
where the emphasis in the words,
where they're like going, I have to look away because I can't look at the person right now. Like, I fall to that because then I'm like,
Well, that's when your drama takes over, because Jen's an actress, so that's where your training kicks into drama over
like what literature. Is a sentence,
right? And we've worked with you on punctuation sometimes because it's like, but this is how I'd say it out loud. I'm like, it's not a play, We're going to put a comma and then a semicolon. There you go. You're done. Yeah,
Exactly. But I'd be breathing there.
I know you would.
Right. And I started in theater too. So I was in theater in LA and characters, to me, I hear them first.
Kim, it's what were you doing in LA as theater? What were you doing here?
Oh, this is so long ago. My God.
I still want to know.
Long ago. I moved out of there a long time ago, but I did.
Smart.
Cloud Nine. Very long time ago, but I switched to writing because I just couldn't see myself as an actress. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. I
like animals and I like to be in one place. I didn't want to audition every year at different regional theaters.
For a while. And then I was like, oh my gosh, it's just so much. And
besides, we have plenty of rejection in the literary world. You don't need it for
having. Exactly. I want to be rejected in a different way.
Yeah, intellectually,
exactly. More personal. Not based on the fact that I'm not the right look.
Right.
I can do that all the time.
That's called dating.
That's easy. Exactly.
That is hilarious.
I think we should have Kim send us her dialogue and we'll do it like Mad Lib style. So remove the problematic word and we'll just give new words. They won't be helpful words.
They won't be helpful.
But it'll be funny.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, it would be hilarious.
We'll insert random animals. Have you considered using a tamarind in this line? There were not tamarinds back in 1875.
Porcupine quills. I'm like, it's New Hampshire. We've got to say New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Porcupine.
Mm-hmm.
Fox.
Some random deer gets hit by a carriage.
Raccoons. I finally moved
out of the having to name all the bushes there and all the plants and everything. So that was all very much in the 1855 one. There was like,
everything. You were naming the bushes?
Everything. You knew what everything was that was in the woods. And then I realized it's part of, you know, it's the things you do that are unconscious, but they're part of our lives as we move from rural to more industrial is mm-hmm. we start losing names of things that were very common to know.
Bush?
At the time.
Bush.
Now bush. Now we're like bush. I fell in the brush. But then it was like, I fell in the oak, whatever it was, the silver maple, not the red maple, because they only had this kind.
Well, I appreciated the shout out to the silver maple because I turned to my husband and I said, your favorite tree is in this book.
Oh, tell your husband it's my favorite tree.
He's the producer. He's listening right now.
There you go.
Roman, it's your favorite tree.
It's your favorite tree, Roman.
I didn't even know he had a favorite tree.
When you live in New Hampshire, you do have favorite trees.
But you mean like a favorite kind of tree, not like a specific tree, right?
I think he has one that every time he sees it, he's like, oh, it's so beautiful. But it's a silver maple. Okay. It's a very specific silver maple. But he likes them in general.
I live in a sort of small town that's all around the wine country in Oregon. But I used to live in Portland and I'd drive down the freeway and there was one cherry tree just on the freeway, a scraggly thing, but it bloomed. It was the first thing that bloomed. And so when I knew that bloomed pink, I said, oh my God, we're out of the season of depression. Life will be good again.
It's a seasonal, anti-seasonal depression tree.
Yeah, it is. Like, and it was just like, I would look for it all of March, right? Just like waiting for that tree because it's very depressing here.
Instead of open, it's bloom, bloom, bloom.
Yeah. And it would just happen like that. It would be like nothing, scraggly, and then completely pink.
Love it.
Love that tree.
Well, Kim, I hate to stop. We could talk to you all night, but you have edits to do.
You do.
Oh, I love talking to you guys. And I don't know if we've... How much?
You're in no way avoiding doing those edits right now.
We talked about writing.
Please, we will. Let's continue on. Let's read Gilead.
We'll read aloud to each other for hours, and then we'll do a lantern show. Kim, you are welcome back anytime.
I would love to talk about
trees, bricks, writing, your books, of course. Just
I would love to. Anytime. You guys are so awesome.
Thank you.
I appreciate you. And I appreciate you.
Cheers. Thank you to Roman, our producer, and Pam Stack, our executive producer. This has been a copywritten podcast for the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and we will see you all next week. Waving.